This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 4, Talent versus Hard Work. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we have a chat about what's more important, your genes or how hard you work in order to achieve success in cricket. We also answer a couple of bowling questions. One about a tall spinner who is over-pitching the ball, and one from somebody who is doing well in nets but can't seem to transfer that over into games. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome again to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to coaching better cricket, to playing better cricket, and better cricket all round. My name is David Hinchliffe, and I'm joined, as always, by Mark Garraway, the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. Hello, Garras.
How are we all?
Very good, thanks. And, of course, published course coach on Pitch Vision Academy as of last week.
Yeah, very exciting.
How are things at the school with you at the moment?
Yeah, good. Had a very, very good week, actually. Last couple of days have been fantastic. We're just into a power hitting phase with the World Cup coming up and all the one day cricket that's on the television at the moment. We've seen some really good examples of that over the last few weeks, from AB de Villiers to Andre Russell to various other people. So we're looking to replicate some of that. It's topical. It's going to be on our tellies for the next few weeks and months. So it's a good time for us to be practicing those skills, and the kids have taken to it really well, which has been very exciting.
How do you program something like that? Is that something that it's as and when you take the opportunity when it arises, or is that something that you can plan ahead for in a bit more detail?
Well, I think it's really important that we look to plan. Whilst there's plans that you stick around each and every player that you have come into your program, you've also got to have a look at what's happening around the world, because they're going to be engrossed in this format, aren't they, of short format cricket over the course of the next few months, with the World Cup being on and all of the warm-up games that are going on presently. The BBL, which has been such a fantastic tournament, has incorporated a lot of those sort of things. So whilst it's around them, it's good, particularly for the people that are very good at copying what they see, to have that put in part of their programme. And it's something that over the years I found is really, really good to drop in, you know, so they can actually watch it on the telly and then replicate the stuff in the nets and in their practice sessions.
Yeah, and it's a bit different, isn't it, from what perhaps people have been used to with coaches, you know, teaching the, you know, play straight and block the good ones, yeah, and all that kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been brilliant fun, and I think a number of them have surprised themselves with what they've achieved, which is always a good thing.
Now, all this time, I've been studiously ignoring the other presenter on this show, so let's sort that problem out straight away. It's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers, and sorry about chatting away with Garras there and completely ignoring you.
Not a problem. That's absolutely fine. I'm actually more than happy to listen and learn, as is always the case.
How do you program power hitting?
We're actually going to do a power hitting, not month. We've got about three sessions penciled in, which are going to start in about 2 weeks' time. We're just going through a phase of finishing off what I would call hard work batting. So we're doing some stuff against, about a couple of weeks, against real high quality, high swing, high speed. And we're going to try and do some stuff that's a little bit more fun over the next 2 or 3 weeks once we've got next week out of the way. So, it's difficult to program and stick to it rigidly, because everyone's going to learn at different speeds and everyone's slightly different ability level and learn in different ways. But I think we have, or I have a number of things that I want to achieve throughout the winter or the season or the session or the period or however we want to term it. And more often than not, we seem to get through all those things. And that also leaves a little bit of time for boys to own their own and lead their own sessions as well, based on what they feel they need to do in addition to the general programme they work through.
Yeah, it's always a balance, isn't it, between wanting to get as much in as you can and having sort of an experience of trying different things and then going deep on a subject as well. You know, there's never enough time to go as deep as you like on every single thing. So you need to work out and be quite dynamic about what where you're going to really dig deep and where you're going to give someone an experience of something, but it's going to be a very shallow experience because you've got to move on to other things.
Absolutely. I think it's difficult. It's very easy to try and teach everything to everyone and work through a plan on an annual basis. But actually, I don't know about Gareth, but in my eyes, there are a number of things that I'd like boys, by the time they reach 15 or 16, there are a number of things I'd like the boys to be able to do at that stage. And by the time they leave the school, I think there might be some more things we'd like them to do as well. So it's more of a 3 or 4 or even 5-year plan rather than a 1-year plan. So where the boys in years 7, 8 and 9 may touch on certain things, other boys in years 12 and 13 might spend a little bit more time on them. So it's all going to be slightly varied, and hopefully it kind of works for those individuals at their stage of development.
And talking about sort of working hard and trying to develop things, one of the things that I've been thinking about a little bit this week is the genetic side of talent compared to the hard work side of talent. It's a debate which has gone back and forth, and I'm not sure it's something which we've ever particularly nailed down the opinions of both of you guys on it. There's two arguments, really, isn't there? There's one argument that says talent is an overrated thing. It's mostly down to environment and putting in the right type of practice and volume of practice. And there's another school of thought that says, well, there's a lot more genetics that come into it, and both have their supporters and both have their backers with books and things like that. So I was trying to think to myself, where would you both be on that continuum between, at one end, you've got everything is completely genetic, and the other end, everything is completely down to hard work. How far along that scale would you say that you were?
Well, I'm in a fascinating, I'm sure that Sam's similar, I'm in a fascinating environment when you look at this discussion, because my philosophy would go more down the environment route and more down the hard work and the doing things right, the behaviours, the processes. And I think that they're important for everybody. But it's quite interesting when you come to environments such as Millfield or Portsmouth Grammar School or a number of the other schools that are operating out around the world that put on good programmes, is that you tend to find that the whole sporting gene thing does rear its head. So I look at our first 15 at rugby, and our 10 and our 12 and our 13 playing rugby have all got within their families either dads or brothers of dad have all got British Lions as parents or uncles. I look in our cricket program as well, and we've got the son of an international cricket coach here who's a very fine player in his own right. We've got son of an international S&C coach here, who's a fantastic player in his own right. We've got a lad from Zimbabwe whose father was a first-class cricketer over there. We've got another lad whose uncle played for South Africa. Another lad whose uncle played for South Africa a lot. So it's an interesting one for me, because I always went down the route of the environment, and now I'm in a place where I'm trying to develop an environment. But as I look at lists of key kids that are coming into the school and the people that are attracted to come to Millfield, there is a very strong element of sporting gene within there as well. So another one of my experiences was Stuart Broad. You know, Stuart Broad obviously grew up around international and county cricket, developed a number of skills which were associated with those environments, but also picked up a huge amount from being Chris Broad's son. I think when you get that mix between environment and the gene, it's absolutely optimal, which is what we see with somebody like Stuart. And that's what I'm experiencing a little bit here. But again, going back to my core philosophy, I think if you get your environment right, you get the behaviours around people right, then you can't go too far wrong. And my best two examples of that, I suppose, having been lucky enough to work with them, are Graham Smith and Paul Collingwood, that wouldn't necessarily come under the sporting gene one, but would come more under what is put around them and the attitudes that they brought into their practice and their gameplay.
So there's definitely a balance there, Lavers. I'm pretty sure you would agree with that. I suppose my follow-up question to you would be, do you think someone who is of a lesser genetic talent can overcome that by the application of things like deliberate practice and not giving up when it seems like things are going against them.
They may always be fighting against it to a degree, but there's always going to be an ability to improve in everyone. And I do on occasions get quite frustrated with people who will say, well, so-and-so will never be this. Little Johnny will never be able to do this. Well, let's not rush into make hasty decisions. All any individual can do is try and get a little bit better each day. And if we work to a long-term plan and they have the environment and the desire to do so, well, people can improve every day. People can improve week by week. And it may be that the goal of someone is a long, long way off and it looks unachievable. And largely you'll find that a lot of people will possibly lose interest and their commitment to their what they want to achieve will drop as they move towards that goal because it's so far away. And that's where those with a genetic advantage maybe are a little bit closer to the goal in the first place. But there's no reason people can't always look to improve. And if the environment is suitable, then there's no reason people can't stick to it and hopefully achieve their goals as long as that desire is there and as long as that environment is there as well. I also think genetically you do get that genetic advantage possibly, which can be passed on, but it's not necessarily the parents' genetics that have caused these boys to get to where they are. It's also the environment created by those parents. So there's a combination of things that's coming into play. It's not just the genes that are putting those boys in the rugby team or those boys in the cricket team or the fast bowlers or whatever. So we have to accept that there's going to be a degree of that. But yeah, I think we can always improve. And if people stick at it long enough, then there's no reason they can't get there in the end.
Let's wrap this up then with the yes-no round. Three questions to finish off this section that can only be answered yes or no to, no matter how much more the team want to say. So the first question is, risk-taking breeds results.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question, repetition is the key to learning.
Not necessarily.
No. Not necessarily.
You can't say that.
The yes, no, not necessarily.
Well, you can edit that bit out if you want. It's a no.
Third question, there are two types of people, those who do the work and those who take the credit.
Yes.
Yes.
It's time now for the mailbag. A couple of questions that are sent in by you, the listener, to this very show, or perhaps you're a reader of the Pitch Vision Academy website and you've sent in a question to us. We answer all the questions on this very podcast, and the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions into us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And there's some more details we'll have about that at the end of the show. First question is from Prakash. And Prakash says, I'm a left arm spinner and I'm very tall. And I have a problem that my balls are overpitched or I bowl full tosses. I have a high arm action. So what should I do? I guess the implication here is that because he's tall and he's got a high arm, he's overpitching everything. Is that a correct assumption that he's making there, Gareth?
It can be. It can be. And rather than the high arm, I mean, we'd encourage people to bowl from the top of their height. And as long as they're not going beyond the perpendicular, which may compromise their ability to spin the ball or keep the ball on a certain axis. So we'd like you to stay high as long as you're that side, right side of the perpendicular. As left arm spinner, it would be, if I'm standing behind you, it would be on the left side of that. We want you to stay. The main thing, and this relates a little bit back to last week, actually. You know, we talked about the hip last week and the role of the hips in helping to generate spin within that last chain of the kinetic chain. The other thing that's that hip does by coming through is it makes your release position a bit more in front of yourself when you bowl rather than directly behind your head. It does two things. So that adjusts the flight of a ball. So it means that the ball is released later, which means it will go slightly flatter, and also it will go down into the pitch a little bit more. Not bowling flat, not bowling darts, but it will go down into a pitch rather than being released off of the back foot, which it sounds like it is here, that the bowler's released off his back foot and therefore is over pitching on a regular basis. So the first thing I'd do is maintain that high arm, but I would incorporate more hip action, which would then delay the release position. You'll find that the ball will go down into the pitch rather than going floating up and being driven too much. And you'll probably find that you'll get a little bit more on the ball as well. And again, the more the hip works, generally, when we look at the side, the further the release position ahead of the centre of body mass. Down to me is Prakash is bowling directly over the top of the centre of his body mass rather, or even behind the centre of his body mass rather than slightly in front of it.
Leivis, have you ever seen a bowler with this kind of a problem?
Well, I actually made a few notes on this one, and there are a few kind of words I've put down, and one of them is body action, which is kind of referring to what Gareth has said with his hips, which I wanted to suggest whether or not he is driving through his action. I mean, the large thing I'm thinking about is what direction is the ball spinning? This comes down to something I talked about last week, but are we getting that overspin on the ball, or is he simply bowling with side spin? And as Gareth said there, it sounds like the ball may be floating rather than dropping. And one thing we could do is look at the direction of the revolutions on the ball. Are we getting that top spin or overspin combined with the side spin to try and get the ball dropping a little bit more? And why is that? And one of the things I put down, as I said, was body action, which kind of relates to Gareth's with that hip movement, which are allowing the shoulders to rotate up and over and get him up over the top of the ball out in front of himself. The other thing I put down would be alignment, which could be another reason that he's not getting over the top of the ball. If you find yourself a little bit closed off, again, the body can't work very well, and you bowl the ball from a position where you start to undercut it a little bit more. So that would be the other suggestion I'd look at. Presumably, it sounds like he's quite consistent in this area. So if he's not able to adjust or adapt to those areas with alignment or using his body a little bit more, and presumably he's following through reasonably well as well, but he may just want to look simply in the short term at how he adapts his head position to alter his body angle to adapt his release position. So just by dropping his height of sight a little bit, he might be able to come up with a short-term fix, which just gets the ball a little bit shorter. It doesn't necessarily get the ball dropping how we'd like it ideally as a spinner, but it might be a short-term fix for him.
And although full tosses are not great, it's not such a horrendous offence to bowl an over-pitched delivery as a spinner, because if you're getting the batsman driving, then you're in the game, aren't you?
Yeah, I agree with that. If you're going to go one way of the two, unless you've got a specific plan and you're looking to contain somebody by bowling back of a length and into the stumps to give them no whip to work to, I'd always encourage people to over pitch rather than under pitch. Just looking at the question and reading the question over and over again, he's obviously very tall. I think he's been encouraged to bowl with a high action, and that is probably meant to the fact that he's bowling behind the centre of his body mass because he's trying to bowl as high as he possibly can rather than using those hips and letting go of the ball in front of himself. And that's what the likes of, if you think about a Graham Swan at release position, who for an off spinner is as good an example as anybody that we've seen in the last 10 years or so bowling with, you know, without having throwing chucked at him at any stage of his career. I would suggest you have a look at him from sideways on, and his release position is always in front of his centre of body mass, and that's because he's used his hips well. So Prakash, have a go at using them hips, getting your centre of your release ahead of your centre of body mass, and I'm convinced that those balls will land into a length and be bowled into a length rather than being overpitched on a regular basis.
Next question is from Vatsal. And Vatsal says, I'm 15 years old. In nets, I tend to bowl at the fastest pace I can reach, and I'm able to seam the ball in and out and do all sorts of things quite easily, and I concentrate at 100%. But in games, I mark a perfect run-up and I feel a great rhythm, but as soon as I release the ball, I have the worst seam position, and even tail-enders are able to read what ball I'm about to bowl. I don't bowl many wides, but I'm just not finding the length I want, and I'm not moving the ball in games. Would you have any tips or anything that I could improve on this?
Yeah, I think first of all, I think it's really key that you do assess your performance as accurately as you can. So ask those guys around you and see if you can get a little bit of feedback as to what they feel is going wrong. You say you get the worst seam position. It's quite difficult for bowlers to assess their seam position, especially if they're quick bowlers. So I would say try and get a little bit of feedback from your keeper on your seam position and see what he thinks. Again, speak to your slip, speak to your mid-off, and make sure that the seam position is one thing that you really think isn't going right, because we don't want to go down the avenue of trying to fix something and it's not necessarily the right thing that we're trying to do, because ultimately it could be that you're actually getting the ball, presenting the seam quite nicely, but the pitch conditions are different. Or there is another variable which is causing your bowling to be less effective in a match situation than it is in a training situation. So first of all, I would definitely look at that and try and get some guys around to give you a bit of support. In terms of reading the ball, it'd be interesting to see what options you've got and how they do read the ball. So presumably your teammates, you would imagine, can read the ball quite well, even though you seem to be quite confident in how you bowl at them. But obviously guys who face you very often should be able to identify when you're bowling any form of variation. So try and work out what it is people are identifying. Can you identify how people are spotting your cutters or slow balls and when you're adapting your swing? And can you then in turn try and disguise it in a different way? So it sounds like you're very much based on variation rather than being an out-and-out quick bowler. So these are obviously really important things to you. But yeah, I'd try and get a little bit of feedback from around you, first of all. It's good to see that you're not bowling wides. So if you're still putting the ball on a good line, that length is the issue. What's the difference between a match and a training game? Probably maybe a little bit of tension, maybe a little bit of nervousness. Maybe it's something that you obviously identified as a clear problem because you've obviously wrote it to us and identified, and maybe that's something that is building, or you're building on yourself just by creating more pressure than you actually need. But yeah, I'd be interested to see what Gareth says about this, because it's always difficult for people to understand why their training and performance environment are so different to them.
Gareth, let's assume that there is a difference between his performance in the nets and his performance in the middle. You must have seen this many times.
Yeah, and it's one that is probably the most, I wouldn't say the most difficult to get over, but it can be a long journey, this one. And certainly in experience that I've had since I've been at school, we've got two or three players in the 3 years I've been here who are incredibly good trainers, fantastic trainers, that don't then find a way to be able to put that performance down on the pitch. And I'm going to come back to that in a second, if that's all right. But firstly, going back to Sam's external view of yourself as a bowler. You say in there that people are picking what you're able to bowl, and even the tail enders are being able to read the ball that I'm about to bowl. How do you know that? Would be my first point. You know, can you really say that is, or is that what you think is happening? Because this is actually linked into the next bit, which is setting up your own expectations, being realistic in your reviews, how to manage your physiology and your mental processes as you run up to bowl and go into your bowling action. Because I can guarantee you that most of the tail enders I've played with, worked with, and now coach wouldn't necessarily be able to read what ball is going to be coming at them. So you might be playing against some different types of tail enders to myself, but I wouldn't put yourself down that much, and only include that as a valid statement if you can actually back that up, having spoken to the opposition batters and for them to have given you enough credibility or credible answer to make you think that they actually are picking it. I don't think they are, mate. I think you're being a bit hard on yourself. And secondly, and going into this, the next bit, you mentioned here that you mark a perfect run-up, you have a feel, a great rhythm, but as soon as I release the ball, I happen to have the worst seam position. Blah-de-blah-de-blah. So it sounds to me as if your run-up's great, but it's that next point. And I'd be interested and I'd explore how you feel in your run-up to how you feel as you jump into your delivery stride. Because often players will report that that rhythm in their run-up is there, and then all of a sudden, as they take off, they feel different tensions, as Sam talked about, in the body. And it particularly manifests itself in the shoulders and then through your arms, your forearms, and to your wrist, and then into the last contact on the ball, which is the fingers. Breathing can help that. So if you know that as you jump, you start to get tension across the shoulders, and it's a fairly common thing, then try different breathing techniques. It might be that you breathe out just ahead of delivering the ball. It may be that you hold your breath just ahead of a ball. It can be different for different people. But try a different breathing technique, because often our breathing then has a direct effect on our physiology, and in particular around the shoulders, the forearms, and the fingers. Because when I'm talking about seam position here, it's often that last chain which affects the seam position, which is then delivered. So that would be my first starting point with you. And without working with you closely and getting feedback from the bowler, that would be my first thing. Change your breathing patterns as you jump into your delivery stride. Have an experiment between having air inside your lungs, so your lungs full of air as you let go of the ball, and then contrast that with how it feels when you then breathe out as you're bowling the ball, or just ahead of bowling the ball, and see which one has a difference in the tension that goes through your shoulders, forearms, and into your fingers.
Soapbox time, and that means 1 minute, 60 whole seconds of an uninterrupted rant, argument, question or comment from one of the members of the team. And stepping up into the soapbox this week, it's Sam Lavery. When you're ready, Lavers, go ahead.
Okay, one of the things I want to talk about is how we change and develop as coaches. I speak to a lot of our boys a lot about comfort zones, and I hear Gary's talking to guys about comfort zones as well, and a lot of coaches talk about it. And sometimes I wonder, how often do we try and take ourselves out of our comfort zones? Recently, I was talking to a coach, and they had a plan that worked, and they're quite a good structure for their sessions for their senior cricketers, and it was what they did every single year. It wasn't something that had caused any problems, so they were very much keen to stick to it. And one of the things I thought is, well, why don't we actually try and look to develop ourselves as coaches? Why don't we look to try something new? We're always encouraging our players to experiment and to be creative. Let's try and apportion a little bit of time each year for ourselves, where we're going to be creative as well. So have a look at your program, have a look at what you've got in there, look at what your non-negotiables are that need to stick, and see if you can open up a little bit of space for some creativity and take yourself outside of your comfort zone.
And that is the end of the show for another week. A couple of questions we've answered, and of course, we need to decide on the best one of the week that wins the prize, which is the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Gareth, we had Prakash's question about over-pitching his balls, and Vatsal's question about the difference in performance between nets and games. Which one did you prefer this week?
I'm going to go to Vatsal this week. I thought, the real tricky thing about getting your performances in practice across into your performance in game is something that has missed a few of us, including myself, on that one. It's a real art to do it. But because of the information that he was able to give us about the rhythm in his run-up, I think that we were able to give him some really good information back that he can then use with. So, using his game. So, that's all your this week's winner.
And congratulations to you. Now, people can send in their questions if they were thinking to themselves, you know, I want that prize, I want that question answered. So, Gareth, how would they get in touch with us to do that?
They can give us a call on 0203 239 7543, or they can drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That is correct. Our Twitter is also a way of getting in touch with us at Pitch Vision Acad, and where most people get in touch with us is through Facebook, which is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. Lots of people over there chatting about all things cricket coaching and playing related. If you want to listen to this show every week, you can do that by subscribing. Find your podcast app on your phone or your tablet and click click on the subscribe button once you've done a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You can also use iTunes or anything like that to do the same thing. And if you want to do it the old-fashioned way with an RSS feed, then you go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link for all the details in there. You also find the show notes there too. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Thanks, guys. Cheers, boys.